Hill. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California. But please hold your calls for the time being because we have with us a very special guest. His name is Dr. John Martin, and Dr. Martin is a physician. He's has his PhD as well, and he's a virologist, and he has been working for many years trying to understand the progressive neurological degenerative diseases that really are, at the present time, are quite unexplainable. And, well, I'm going to let Dr. Martin open the story because when he first went to work, he worked for a time with the Federal Drug Administration back in Washington, D.C., and of course, he was working there with poliovirus. So I'll let him tell the story. Dr. Martin, thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, good afternoon, Stan, and thank you again for the opportunity to bring some attention to the fact that there are viruses out there in our community causing these chronic neurological diseases, everything from the chronic fatigue type relatively mild diseases to the very devastating diseases that are hospitalizing patients with unexplained brain illnesses, sometimes called Parkinson's, Alzheimer's in young children, autism. But the point to be made is essentially that atypical viruses exist. Viruses exist that do not engage our immune system. And this is what these viruses have been referred to as stealth viruses. And the primary purpose of this call is, again, to emphasize the need for government to look at, take seriously, assess the presence of these viruses. They do exist. I know that there's been hesitation to consider them, because some have clearly come out of vaccines.
All right, fine. Well, let's go back to the beginning of the story. One thing I did want to ask you is, when these diseases are in the nervous system, is there microscopic evidence of damage or degenerative changes in the tissues?
Absolutely. And this is, having kind of worked on it for 10 years, literally 10 years ago, a school teacher from Palm Springs came into the University of Southern California. Because of one of these illnesses, a very small brain biopsy was taken, as would be done to try to understand the cause. Looked at by most pathologists, they would dismiss the idea of an infection because there was none of the white cells and flaming into the area. It basically didn't have an inflammatory response. But when I looked at those same cells using both electron microscopy and very careful regular microscopy, the cells in the brain showed this vacuolization. It means I had a lot of vacuoles, a lot of lipid material. And what was fascinating at the time was there was, in addition, a lot of unexplained material inside these cells, which we now have identified as an alternate energy source for the cell induced by the virus.
All right, fine. Well, why don't we start back when you were working for the Federal Drug Administration? What was it, about 1977?
Well, yeah, and from 1975 to 1980, I was assigned a task within the Bureau of Biologics of FDA on the NIH campus, and the task was to basically run research but keep an eye on the concerns that people had that some vaccines could potentially carry viruses that might cause cancer.
But of course that was because of the debacle with the rhesus monkey being used to grow the polio vaccine that was used in the original Sabin vaccine, wasn't it?
Yeah, and let's take that back a little bit. You're right.
Salk vaccine, right.
Yeah, when they first started with polio vaccine, they ran into a problem that the monkey species used to make the vaccine, a rhesus monkey, was found to contain simian virus 40, which Dr. Eddy and other people had noted could cause cancer in animals. And recently there's been suggestions of these viruses in some human cancers. But that concern about SV40 led to a very rapid switch from rhesus monkey to an African green monkey. As those studies were done, the production of polio vaccine continued, and in fact it switched from an inactivated form that Dr. Salk had proposed to an quite active form that Dr. Sabin had proposed, active but weakened virus. Now, what basically happened through that switch occurred in the early 1960s, and through the 1960s there were these continuing concerns that perhaps the use of live polio vaccine could introduce unexplained viruses and so forth. That led in 1972 to a very formal study to take 12 monkeys, set aside the cultures from their kidneys, and see if anything would grow out. There was relief that there wasn't the Marburg virus, like Ebola virus, and there wasn't some other viruses there. But what was disturbing, all 12 monkeys grew out a cytomegalovirus, a type of herpes virus. I did not know that when I was working at FDA, and in fact, when I found DNA in some of these vaccines that couldn't be explained, I wasn't informed of this earlier study. I have since come to realize that FDA at the time, with this information, decided, perhaps with the encouragement of industry, that since there was no sign of damage occurring, acute damage occurring from polio vaccine, it was okay to look the other way, let this observation slip through, and essentially not tell anybody about it, but continue the production.
So after they'd already, of course, infected an awful lot of people with the simian virus 40 from the Salk vaccine, then, of course, when they changed over to the green monkey, and this was about a decade later in 1972, they've been giving everybody the Sabin vaccine for 10 years. Somebody checks and finds there is a herpes or a monkey herpes or cytomegalovirus virus in the polio vaccine that they've been giving for a decade. Now, can this monkey virus, the green monkey virus, infect people?
Absolutely. What happened kind of almost like things go around to come around.
I'm going to have to interrupt you. I suddenly realized we're going to have to take a break. I got so involved in the story. We're going to be back here. And, of course, this is the time when I just want to mention that if you're out there in the listening audience and you'd like to help Radio Liberty, you can change your long-distance carrier over to Promise Vision. And you do that by calling 866-448-5631. That's 866-448-5631. And when you do that, why, 15% of your long-distance bills comes to us. Now, we like them. We think their prices are competitive. Their service has been excellent. But the nicest thing about Promise Vision is if you call the company, you get a real live person. And not only that, but 15% of whatever you spend on long-distance calls will come to us. The number to call is 866-448-5631. That's 866-448-5631. That's Promise Vision. And then, of course, we carry the Miracle 2 soap products. And the one thing we can guarantee is that it's excellent soap. But many of the people who use them feel that it's helped their rashes, or that some of the people who have just intractable heartburn and have been taking from their physician, of course, the various antacids. Have said that the neutralizer helps them. It's certainly not approved by the FDA for that, but I know my wife uses it, and she's very happy, and we have an awful lot of people to use the neutralizer to control heartburn. All I can say is that you ought to try the products. If you like them, why you use them. If not, why you won't. But most people, most of the business we have are people who keep coming back again and again because they like the products. So you can get the soap, moisturizing soap, neutralizer, lotion, and gel for a packet simply by calling 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Or you can, of course, get information. Give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Now, most people laugh at the idea that there is or has been secret societies. I wanted to tell you about a tape we have. It's a talk I gave before the Concerned Women of America some years ago, and it basically goes back into the background behind the secret society, which was formed in England and eventually came to America and came to be known as the Council on Foreign Relations. It goes into the background of Cecil Rhodes. And how does that secret society that he created impact on you today? If you read the works of Professor Carol Quigley, who was Bill Clinton's mentor, you'll understand that Professor Quigley is probably one of the leading experts today on history, but also a man who had the courage to speak out. You need to get the four-tape set, The Secret Government, to understand what Professor Quigley taught Bill Clinton. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America is under attack today. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Dr. John Martin. And Dr. Martin is, of course, both a physician and a virologist. He has a PhD and an MD, which is a sort of an unusual thing. But, of course, he's well-versed then in both medicine and in science. And we've been talking about what happened. I mean, first of all, you have the debacle with the rhesus monkey, and this has a simian virus in it, a cancer-producing virus. And, of course, it's given to 98 million doses of this are given in the United States. Well, of course, we can't let the American people know what's going to happen. So we're going to change from the rhesus monkey, which carries SV40, to the African green monkey. But they didn't bother to check out to find if they had viruses. So a decade later, in 1972, why, of course, the manufacturers, and was that the FDA or the manufacturers who did that report?
It was a conjoint study with both.
All right, fine. So pick up the story from there, because, of course, they decided, well, we're not going to tell anybody. Maybe nothing will happen.
So when a virus was isolated from a lady who had chronic fatigue syndrome back in 1991, we could show that that particular virus was unusual in that it did not evoke an inflammatory reaction in the patient, but it was causing her devastating illness. And she's continued to today sick with a whole variety of illnesses, but essentially her life has wasted away from this continuing infection. The second patient was a lady who had been initially called schizophrenic. The diagnosis was changed to manic depressive illness. She too was infected with a virus, and that too, when we looked at it in detail, was derived from an African green monkey simian cytomegalovirus. Now, the real issue here, Stan, is that rather than looking at that upfront and saying, gee, we need to address it, there's been that tendency to dismiss it and say, well, these viruses don't exist and so forth. So the research has continued, and it's been slower than it would have been with support.
Well, I think it's really so interesting that back in 1995, for some unknown reason, why the government says, well, we're only going to use Sabin vaccination. That's the live vaccine that has these green monkeys. We're only going to use that half the time, and we're going to have soft vaccine half the time. And then in January of 2000, correct me if I'm wrong, but then the government said, now we're going to do away with this Sabin vaccine, which is incidentally an excellent vaccine. It's 100% effective. Well, it's got green monkey viruses in it. They didn't tell you that. And we're going to go back to the salt vaccine, which is only 40 to 50% effective. And why would they do that? Why would they give up a 100% effective vaccine? Well, as they said, there are 8 people got infected every year because of the Sabin vaccine. And I don't believe that was the real reason they changed at all. Do you?
No, again, I know from discussions with people in the vaccine immunization committees and so forth, that a concern was raised by the research that we had done at the time, and that issue came up as people would ask questions whether or not the inactivation process back now with Salk vaccine would affect the stealth viruses. I think, again, that rather than looking back and saying, I wish they had done this in 72, 77, 95, and so forth, I think the time is ripe now to bring this work directly to the attention of CDC and FDA, have them look at the data, and basically put back on the spot to respond. The one optimism I have with government is that they more or less can blame predecessors and so forth and look at it freshly. So I'm in some ways very sad for the fact that something could have been done and perhaps these infections prevented back in 72. Something could have been done when we first announced to FDA in 1994 that these atypical viruses existed, and then showed convincing enough data in 95 that some of them had come from the polio vaccines. Now the issue is irrefutable. There's been enough research conducted in the last several years to basically put the onus back on CDC and FDA to disprove it, or if they can't, really to address it, as it is a public health menace, a major public health concern, and it's not fair to the many patients out there infected with these viruses that we have an indifferent government.
Well, now, what is the incidence of infection in the general population and, say, in children with autism? Because autism has increased 600% over the last 20 or so years. I mean, this is simply exploding, and the number of children with autism is just truly frightening. But what's the incidence of this? These African green monkey herpes viruses in the general population, and then in people with these terrible neurological diseases?
So let me just add a comment first. Research is terrific. You get new, fresh answers if it's done well. The data are convincing and so forth. So what the study with the African green monkey showed me was that a virus could exist that would not evoke an inflammatory reaction, yet would be able to damage cells in the patient or in the animal, if it's an animal study, or in a test tube. That process, stealth adaptation process, having been defined with a simian cytomegalovirus, can potentially occur with any type of human virus, certainly any type of human herpes virus, whether it's Epstein-Barr virus, cytomegalovirus, human herpes virus 6, and so forth. If we take that broad grouping, then, of stealth-adapted viruses, then unfortunately, at least 10% of the population are infected. And then when we look at populations like autistic children, children with very hard-to-handle behavioral problems, learning problems, eating disorders, virtually all of them are going to be infected. Specifically with the autistic children, in a double-blind study, it was some 80% of the autistic children had clear evidence of being infected. And unfortunately, the data are just sort of so black and white. There's an increasing incidence of these illnesses. Atypical viruses exist, and I seem to be somewhat alone trying to link the two together and get that association on the front burner, if you want, or on the agenda of CDC and FDA. After all, it's really their responsibility, being in charge of the nation's health, to look at these issues and not basically shy away from it because it might have some negative implications regarding vaccine safety, safety issues in the past.
Well, don't you think that there is almost a fear that if the public were to learn what has happened, that they might lose confidence in the public health service and the CDC, that they would say, can we really trust these people?
And again, having thought about that a lot, I still think reasonable people have no alternative. The easiest way to handle it is not to address it. The appropriate way to do it is to address it with its consequences. And I know absolutely correctly that there is that concern, well, what will we do with the information and so forth. On that regard, again, the research is being helpful because I now have a much, much better understanding of how these viruses are damaging cells and what could be done potentially to benefit it. But any of that further development of therapies and so forth is hindered if the public health authorities are unwilling to even accept the existence of these viruses.
Well, now, of course, you could actually grow this type of virus in the laboratory.
Absolutely.
Is there any sort of a blood test for it, or how can you tell if a patient is infected? Because it's really terribly difficult to grow it, to actually grow it in everybody, isn't it?
Well, I do that well. All in all, I probably do some 600 cultures a year, and it's painstaking and technically demanding, and in fact, probably risky, but it's still very clear that one can grow these viruses in cultures. It takes no more than a blood sample, and that blood sample is processed, added to cells, and then the cells undergo this very characteristic signs of cell damage.
And this is not what you would see with the polio virus or something else?
No. The type of what's called a cytopathic or cell-damaging effect is pretty unique. What is encouraging is it's exactly the same in cultures that we see in the tissues of animals in whom we inoculate these viruses or in the brain biopsies we get from these very severely ill patients. And again, it's become clear that as we are beginning to have patients referred, we do get a chance to review their medical history, that mainstream medicine has yet to learn about these viruses and have tended to dismiss them, the possibility of a viral infection, simply because there's no inflammation.
Well, I think when we get back, certainly we want to tell our listeners how they can get in touch with your organization. And then, of course, we want to get into what can be done for the tragic people with these terrible, terrible infections, because so often they involve the brain. And certainly when you involve the brain, why destroy the brain, you destroy the very essence of the individual. So we'll be back in just a moment with Dr. John Martin. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time I want to tell you about a couple of the products we have. One of them, of course, is the Phenopoly game, and this, of course, is a system. It's 5 board games played just like Monopoly, but when you utilize them, children who've been to government schools and taught to read the wrong way and really are having difficulty of pronouncing words, of reading out loud from a written page, spelling words, and certainly of reading phonetically, you can retrain their brains in 16 to 20 hours, and they will then begin to read phonetically, and all in the process of doing this, they've had fun playing the game. The game was made up by Myrta Culbraith, who made up the phonics game, and of course this is called Phenopoly. It's actually 5 board games, 2 bonus games, and 2 books. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We also have, of course, Dr. Robinson's curriculum to take your children from their first grade all the way through college, and it doesn't take a lot of time on your part. Everything is on CDs. There are 22 CDs, complete set of Encyclopedia Britannica from 1911. Why 1911? Because that's before they begin to rewrite the Encyclopedia Britannica and change history. Anyway, of course, all the texts, the tests, the lesson plans are there. It's $199.95. And the important thing is, of course, that the child will get an excellent, excellent education. The only text you have to buy are the Saxon math books. Give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then we now have the complete list of the members of Skull and Bone Society, this secret society at Yale. And these actually come from members of the society going all the way back to 1833. Give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR and ask for the set. Have you ever wondered about the boys we left behind in Vietnam, in Korea? Did you ever know that we left 25,000 American boys behind in Russia, in Siberia, at the end of the Second World War? Have you ever wondered what really happened at Oklahoma City, what really happened with TWA 800 that went down off the eastern coast about a year ago? Well, ladies and gentlemen, all of the subjects are well covered in a fascinating book by Craig Roberts entitled The Medusa File. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, order The Medusa File. Actually, Craig Roberts was a police officer working on the Oklahoma City bombing. Now, this book has been suppressed very effectively across America. It's self-published, but I promise you that there's no other book I know that will give you more contemporary history, frightening history that every American needs to know. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR now. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is Dr. John Martin. Dr. Martin, how can people get in touch with you and get information on the work that you've been doing?
Well, the information, a lot of information is on the Internet, and there's an address that we have,
www.stealthvirus.com. Okay.
And, but they certainly can call the lab, particularly if people are willing to try to get the message out and can work constructively with public health authorities and basically increase the awareness. And the telephone number in the lab is 626-572-7288. Or if people wish to fax, they could fax to 626-572-9288. And I guess the final contact is through email ccidlab@hotmail.com. The CCID refers to the Center for Complex Infectious Diseases, a very small lab, but we've been pursuing this for some time, and now, as I said, we have sufficiently compelling argument, in fact, an irrefutable argument, that it's time now for involvement of CDC, FDA, to basically address this. And I guess in some ways it'd be nice to have a teamwork approach. There's so many people out there who are in need of recognizing these infections, participating in clinical trials to see what therapies will be most effective, and hopefully preventing this such very common occurrence of people having these strange chronic fatiguing, fibromyalgia, depression, and so forth, illnesses, not knowing the cause, and yet suffering enormous consequences of having their brain function impaired.
Now, of course, what can be done? Because certainly there are no good antivirals at the present time, are they? Or are there? Is there anything from an antiviral point of view, or are you working to try to get people's immunity built up so they can handle their body can handle the disease themselves?
Yeah, basically, the viruses are competing for the resources in the cell. The cell then responds by trying to improve its performance. There's a lot of lipid production. So we sort of have a reasonably good grasp of the process. Then it is determined by how severely ill the person is as to how aggressive to become. But we've seen young children respond to antiviral agents. In California here, over 100 patients per year are being reported to our state health department from hospitals about patients in comatose state, severely ill state, unexplained brain malfunctioning or dysfunction. And until the health departments start to consider these viruses as the cause of these illnesses, there won't be the studies that should be done. In those severely ill patients, there's no question that antiviral agents are indicated. For the patients who have chronic fatiguing type illnesses, they cope so much better when there is an explanation for what's going on. And then we basically have various protocols that support their metabolic function, support the mitochondria as part of the cell, often shows a lot of damage. So we're working with more gentle approaches. And I would tell you, from looking at cultures before and after treatment, there have been very gratifying improvements in some of the cultures and certainly some of the patients.
Well, you know, one of the common stories we hear, from a parent is that my child was perfectly all right, and then they went and they had one of these vaccine cocktails. They got about six vaccines in one day, and a couple of days later, everything just changed. Your response to that, I was really so interested in, that the vaccines actually, at least in the laboratory, actually tend to stimulate these viruses. Could you
Absolutely.
Cover that?
Yeah, and again, it addresses the issue that perhaps vaccines are not for everybody. They certainly do a lot of good, and one can look at the incidence of polio, how it's plummeted with the introduction of vaccines. But my take on it now is that if somebody is stealth virally infected, that person ought not to have their children vaccinated, because you've seen so frequently the exacerbation, deterioration of a child. If I have time, I mean, that one issue before when a mother had a young child dying of sudden infant death syndrome 2 weeks after the vaccine, the mother mentioned that she'd been so careful during her pregnancy for not taking any medications. And I said, why were you treating? What were you being treated for? It was her chronic fatigue syndrome. She had left some breast milk still in her refrigerator, the child having died, sent some to the laboratory, and sure enough, we could show virus in the breast milk. The mother was infected. And this is the type of child who, in my opinion, the public health people should set aside for vaccines, vaccinate the majority of the population, but certainly try to certainly recognize that vaccines can be potentially devastating to somebody who has an infection on board.
Amen to that. And of course, apparently, from what I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, but actually when they take the vaccination, it tends to seemingly, in one way or another, decrease the immunity so that the virus can grow more. Or how does it stimulate the virus activity?
Yeah, absolutely. See, it does so in cultures, so that if I have these stealth viruses growing in culture and then add vaccine viruses there, they basically assist each other. They provide some growth spurt to the virus. And in fact, one can just go to a store and get any number of animal vaccines and do the same thing. So the viruses, the stealth viruses, are stealth because they've lost certain components, in particular the components that the immune system would engage in identifying, targeting the virus. They're somewhat handicapped, but they can be assisted in their growth and replication in the presence of another virus, such as a vaccine virus. So there's a logical reason to avoid adding new viruses into these patients who are already infected.
And then, of course, there's another interesting phenomenon. You know, as an orthopedic surgeon for years, I'd have somebody come in, and they'd get just a little minor whiplash injury, and they'd begin to hurt all over, and it never made any sense to me. I mean, you got hit from behind, you sprained your neck, you got a little ligament damage there, and suddenly you're hurting all over. And yet I heard it enough times that I began to sort of wonder if there might be very well something more, especially now as we begin analyzing some of these other systemic diseases. Have you seen that sort of a story?
Yeah, that's very interesting, Stan. I have seen, unfortunately, all too often the individual who's focusing on neck pain, low back pain, the orthopedic surgeon will focus on the same area, go ahead and do the surgery, only later to realize that that was a contributing factor, but the real underlying cause was the brain dysfunction that lowered the pain threshold, made all the symptoms worse, and in spite of going through the surgery localized to the back or so, the patient is still sick. And there are real good alternatives to surgical treatment once one identifies the systemic nature of these chronic fatiguing illnesses, fibromyalgia, and how those illnesses can exacerbate or exaggerate, if you want, the sensation of pain coming from various parts of the body. And the focus, the better focus on treating those patients is on the brain dysfunction caused by these stealth viruses than on the back and other parts of the body.
All right, fine. Well, let's go to Roger, who's calling from Allentown. Roger, you have a question or comment?
Yes, thank you, gentlemen. And there was a woman, a medical doctor, I'm pretty sure, something like 2 to 4 years ago, was working the Christian talk radio circuit, and the premise of her book, which I haven't read, is that poliomyelitis, the virus, was actually renamed or redefined based on the presentment, the time frame presentment of symptoms to, was it the meningitis or something else, and that's all. God bless, gentlemen.
All right, fine. I have no idea what that what Roger was referring to, but you know, there's no question that polio was a real entity. It was a horrible, horrible disease, and I know when I first became an orthopedic surgeon, there were so many children out there who had really had residual polio, and one of the great accomplishments of all time was, of course, the vaccination program that did away with polio. The only problem was that they hadn't done the work they should have ahead of time, and they hadn't made sure that there were no other viruses in the monkeys where they were growing it. That was the real problem, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, the focus at the time of the early polio vaccine development was to stay away from any cell line that had established itself in culture and to go back to primary tissue freshly taken out from and had to be there for an animal. And Dr. Enders and others had done great work showing that you could grow poliovirus in these animal tissues, but if we had it all over again, no way would we now go to Africa, pull monkeys out, use their tissues to make a vaccine. So at the time, it seemed the right thing to do. Now it seems it was, in fact, and is a very risky business. And the more studies that are occurring looking at monkeys in Africa, the more types of viruses that are being found. The stealth-adapted cytomegalovirus is one. What is useful is that we've learned from studying this virus of a whole process whereby viruses can escape from detection by the immune system, and that hopefully will carry a lot of promise for people who have had these chronic, persisting, neurological, autoimmune, rheumatic kind of illnesses, recognizing that all of these illnesses may well be accountable by this self-adaptation of the viruses.
All right, let's go to Bob calling in here from Santa Cruz. Hi, Bob. How are you doing?
Good. This is really timely. I just listened to Dr. Dean Dell's Medical Minute this morning, and he was talking about vaccines, and he kind of more or less said that it was kind of like a tempest in the teapot, in his opinion, about the complications resulting from vaccination.
Well, of course, that's why Dr. Dean Adell is on so many radio stations all across America.
Yeah, I agree with that, and it's really doing a disservice. He more or less made the statement that just because some condition is correlated with the vaccination doesn't mean that there's any causal relation, and you know, you can have a car accident, and if you had eaten French fries the day before, that doesn't mean French fries caused the accident.
I know, but of course, Doctor. Well, go ahead.
I just want to make a quick comment, and I appreciate, you know, people have their opinions, but we don't want to be blind to complications that are out there. One of the difficulties with the system is that the regulatory agencies, particularly FDA, is not really at liberty to confide in the medical or scientific community about issues relating to vaccines. And I came across that some years ago when it was pointed out that all the information generated on vaccines, for example, that 1972 study, were kept under wraps because the information is deemed proprietary, belonging to the industry, and therefore can't be made public.
Okay, fine. Thank you. We're going to have to take a quick break. Thanks so much, Bob.
Sure.
Okay, and right now, of course, this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you're out there listening across America, why, we hope that many of you will seriously consider helping what we do. And, of course, you can join the Radio Liberty family of supporters for a suggested gift of $20 a month or more. And, of course, you can subscribe to the newsletter. If you'd like a free copy of the newsletter, why, give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WARM. And, of course, if you'd like to go to our website, you're welcome to pull down our newsletters. You can hear about 60 of our programs, which are archived there. But we hope that you'll give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family and helping us as we try to reach out across America with the information that you're not going to get from Dr. Dean Adell or other regular pundits, but, of course, information that I think is valid. And so if you believe that there's a problem, if you wonder why sickness and illness, it really is on the rise here in the United States, why the incidence of new handicapped children is so dramatically increased, and it really is on the rise. The incidence of autism is rising, the incidence of physically and mentally handicapped children is rising, and the incidence of cancer is rising, and nobody wants to ask the question, why? Well, remember our telephone number. It's 1-800-544-8927. If you're not involved, who will be? And if not now, when? So if you'd like to become part of our effort, if you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, why, give us a call. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR.
much.
The book that will really help you to understand the nature of the spiritual battle in which we're currently involved is Gary Kaw's book, The Demonic Roots of Globalism. Now, you may remember Gary Kaw's book, En Route to Global Occupation. His second book, The Demonic Roots of Globalism, goes into the very real spiritual forces, the dark and sinister spiritual forces, which have energized those people who are molding the world in which we live today. Going into the background of Masonry theosophy, and he actually quotes extensively from the writings of these people who have helped to mold the events of the 20th century. The Demonic Roots of Globalism by Gary Kaw will give you tremendous insight into the background of what's happening in America today, and unless you understand the spiritual forces at work, you really can't understand the unfolding of events. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR and ask for The Demonic Roots of Globalism by Gary Kaw.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is Dr. John Martin. And, of course, if you would like to get hold of his laboratory, the telephone number is 626-572-7288. That's 626-572-7288. And then the fax number is 626-572-9288. The email is ccidlab@hotmail.com. And, of course, the website is stealthvirus.com. That's stealthvirus, all one word, .com. And, of course, there are so many things out there. Really, one of the most frightening things is some of the reports as you look, and these aren't really being talked about too much, but it seems that we're really not as healthy as we used to be, and more children are having disabilities. Have you? Is this a factor, do you think, or is this a lot of sensationalism?
No, there's no question of, even in social occasions, so many parents are concerned about their children, the issue of need for special education, the behavioral problems, learning problems that one's seeing. But I published a very detailed paper about one child in particular as he went from 6 to 7 year old. He basically had 7 months of an illness that was accounted for in his schooling and by his parents as simply a behavioral problem. His parents, his mother, in fact, was infected, and she was basically undergoing divorce, as a lot of these patients do, infected people do. The child was not behaving well at school. The teachers thought he was acting out because of the parent's difficulty. Bottom line was, 7 months into an illness process, only then did the mother recognize that there was something organic going on. The child was beginning to see two of everything. The parents took the child to a neurologist specializing in child neurology, and he could not, by regular physical examination, pick up any abnormalities. Yet they did an MRI scan, and that showed gross abnormalities, but because it didn't involve the surface of the brain, it more or less didn't present itself clinically to the neurologist. They went ahead and did a brain biopsy, and as I mentioned earlier, looked at it, and the first reaction was, this can't be an infection because there's no inflammation. They sent pieces of that brain biopsy to NIH for genetic studies, to major centers in this country, and again, people came back with a lot of mumbo-jumbo, in fact, beating about the bush that they didn't know what was going on with this child. Only after we could show that there was a positive viral culture did the child go on antiviral treatment, and that made a significant improvement. The child lived for some 15 months thereafter, eventually died, but there was clear that nobody wanted to listen to this illness as a viral infection for the fact that it was outside the normal bounds. But my take on this was, here's an example where a child has a behavioral problem, learning problem, a viral culture, and yet the regular neurologic exam will not show any obvious abnormalities. And in some ways, the inference from that is that any child with these problems is virally infected until proven otherwise.
And, of course, this is something that's really not widely recognized. Brain biopsies are not the thing you ordinarily do. You only do that when you can't figure out what possibly could be going wrong with a child. And, of course, the tragedy is that if you don't recognize the fact that you can get degenerative changes without inflammation or with these herpes-type viruses, why, the average pathologist really is going to have difficulty to interpreting what he sees, isn't he?
Oh, absolutely. And again, I want to really emphasize, as you said, that the brain biopsies are done rarely, but if those cases are virally infected, then we can be certain that people with a milder form of these diseases, the child who's not doing well at school, oppositionally defiant, eating disorders, and so forth, are likely to be infected. The point was that you don't require a brain biopsy, but they certainly should have their blood cultured to see if there's evidence for a virus. And if there is, they ought to have the benefit of at least a clinical trial to see if some of the approaches that are effective at suppressing these viral activities can bring about some clinical improvement.
All right, fine. Now, what are you suggesting in the way of treatment? Because I think that that is really so vitally important to our listeners.
Yeah, I can't give a detailed one, but I'll say the four S's that we're now proposing. We need to strengthen normal neural networks, the way the brain is functioning. It's striking to me to see the switch of personality, behavior, all of a sudden, if it's a mother dealing with a child or a husband dealing with his wife, the personality changes. Their brain is just functioning differently. And that switch to, from being kind of the person they used to being somebody quite different and so forth, represents the fact that the brain, like the heart can get out of rhythm, the brain can get its rhythms wrong. So the first line of treatment is really along the lines where neurologists and psychiatrists are experts of reprogramming the brain to try and strengthen these neural networks. The second approach, it's fairly general, the mitochondria are the powerhouse inside the cell. They produce energies for the cell, and that's how the cell can continue its function. It's competing now. The resources of the cell are being diverted to the virus. It's necessary then to support the mitochondrial function. And there's a whole slew of approaches to that. Some of them involve over-the-counter supplements. Some of them involve more regular medications. A third approach, without being too technical, is there are growth factors that these viruses, at least the ones that are being characterized, seem to thrive on. And these growth factors have a name, cytokine, chemokine. And again, it opens up the possibility of treating the patient by regulating the cytokine, chemokine pathways. Then we're up to the specific antiviral treatments that do have a place, probably after these other approaches have been tried. I think the other implications and benefit to the physicians is once they recognize that the patients presenting are not simply a psychiatric problem, not something functional, begin to recognize that there's an infection occurring throughout the body, they're more inclined to look for other changes that the viruses can produce.
All right, fine. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Martin. It's really been a pleasure having you with us today. Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners at all?
I think just to basically watch as I'll take these arguments and present it as effectively as I can to both CDC, FDA. Success will be their recognition, their involvement, participation in tackling this major public health crisis that we're facing. So basically, if stealth viruses become a household word, if we do have government programs, then it will have been successful. If it's not, then there will be a lot of people out there still struggling with these illnesses. Eventually, this work will come to the forefront. I'm hoping that it will be sooner rather than later.
I certainly hope so, too. Well, God bless you, and thank you so much for being with us today, Dr. John Martin. Bye-bye. All right, fine. Well, that was Dr. John Martin, and I've had him on for several times. I've known him for a number of years, and he is a very, very responsible, well-known, internationally respected, both physician and scientist. But the reason I asked him to come on, and the reason we told you the story of, first of all, the initial polio vaccine, and incidentally, just last Friday, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal about this. And, of course, there is more and more talk coming out saying that the original polio vaccine was infected with the cancer-producing virus. Now, this is a SV40. And people say, oh, well, just because you find it in tissues now doesn't mean anything. Let me tell you that the scientists, if they want to grow cancers in animals, they give them SV40. They know it produces cancers in hamsters, both mesotheliomas and brain tumors. And almost in every animal they put it into, they find it produces cancers. In fact, the entire idea of doing genome research and trying to find out, trying to map the human genome really started with SV40. Because the scientists had to find out what there was in that monkey virus that produced cancers so readily. And now they're saying, oh, well, just because it produces cancers in animals doesn't mean it produces cancers in human beings. Well, yes, we never saw mesotheliomas, or we hardly ever saw them before, and now we're seeing 3,000 a year. And yes, brain cancers have gone up 40%, and so many of them have the SV40 in them, but that doesn't mean that it produces them. Well, there are many, many very good scientists, among them Dr. Carboni, is a professor of one of the major universities in the East, who spent a great deal of time on this, and it's frightening as you begin to see other increase in non-Hodgkin's lymphomas, and of course so many of these have the SV40 in them. They contaminated the entire human race with a cancer-producing virus, and to the point where about 45% of men, sperm specimens, have the virus, but they can't admit that to the public because then you wouldn't want to take the vaccines that they have planned for you. And the Model Emergency Health Powers Act and the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act, which is being passed all across America, is being passed with one purpose and one purpose alone, and that is for legislation that can force you to be vaccinated. And that's why, of course, they can't let this story we just told you this last hour about the green monkey viruses that infected the people when they replaced the rhesus monkey with the African green monkey. And, of course, if you'd like my latest newsletter, the July newsletter, why, of course, this tells you even more stories of the terrible, terrible mistakes they've made with vaccines. And, of course, will change the way you look at them. Yes, some vaccination programs have been very beneficial, but more than not, have created tremendous, tremendous tragedies, which is why, after being vaccinated during the Gulf War, 28,000 young men are now dead. And, of course, 150,000 of them got the anthrax vaccine, and then somebody destroyed the vaccine records. Do you think that happened by accident? We got real problems, ladies and gentlemen, because evil is alive and well. Until you understand that they're evil people, you can't understand so much of what's going on today. Some of it's mistakes. Some of it is very intentional. Well, we don't have time to develop those ideas. We just ask you to pray for America, to pray for certainly our leaders and our ministers, and pray for revival, and then to remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, goodbye, and may the Lord be with you.
We had last year. there, went over to
Well, we have had a couple of interesting programs, and then a lot of them are talking about it. Really fantastic. And you said it's a really great thing about that. But nobody wants to hear this story. It was after they were contaminated with the monkey cancer vaccine, and now they've given us the herpes vaccine. And you know, you can take me as a kid, but you can't trust the doctor. I can't let that get out. You know, and those protection vaccines.